Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the General Government Transportation Committee. It's Thursday, February the 8th, year 2001. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and open an informational hearing, primarily because we don't have a quorum. But we are taping this meeting, of course, and so we'll make sure that members of our committee are fully informed. Right now, it's been requested, Linda Bai, come on up, representing Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association.
Good afternoon, Chairman George, Senator Carter. The Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, otherwise known as OCAPA, was formed in June of 1967 for the purpose of representing companies whose business is the production of ready-mixed concrete and or the mining of aggregate, the rock that's used in the production of concrete and asphalt. OCAPA represents a mix of producing companies and suppliers, consultants, equipment manufacturers, etc., across the state of Oregon. Each legislative session, OCAPA addresses a variety of legislative concepts that impact gravel mining, land use, and state agency coordination. We are pleased that the state officially recognizes aggregate as a significant statewide resource, and it is our goal to continue working within the guidelines set forth under Goal 5. OCAPA works hard to maintain open lines of communication with the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Department of Water Resources, the Division of State Lands, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and the Oregon Department of Transportation. Of interest to OCAPA this legislative session, highway funding, truck taxes, and land use activities. Also of interest to OCAPA is the supply and demand of aggregate products in the marketplace. As aggregate resources are depleted, new sidings are limited, and Oregon's population increases, Oregon counties are increasingly looking to adjacent counties for aggregate products. The hauling of these products from one county to another concerns us because of the enormous increase in cost. As an example, an unnecessary haul distance of only 10 miles doubles the cost to the customer. OCAPA is sensitive to these economic impacts and is interested and open to finding workable solutions. OCAPA is dedicated to continuing to educate and inform the public about our industry. Thank you.
That was a short report.
Very short.
Linda, hang on, there too. Maybe you can help me.
Okay.
One of the things, last session, we had a report from the concrete producers, and they dealt with some of the new technologies in highway construction. In other words, in the past, we've had, the segmented sections with all the rebar. They were describing the construction of the highway between Highway 5 and Corvallis, that new section of concrete, which I've watched ever since it went in to see how it's doing. It appears to be doing very well. And I understand that cost, do you have any numbers on that, that it was like only about 25% more than building an ordinary construction asphalt?
Chairman George, I don't have that specific information, but I would be happy to confirm that for you.
Could you do that?
Yes, I'll get back to you.
Senator Carter.
Ms. Fye, would you define aggregate products? What do you mean by that for me?
Aggregate is rock and anything that's really mined out of the ground. There are different, just as there are different things farmed, there are different types of rocks that are mined. So there's a whole variety of them, and we just lump them all together and call them aggregate.
This is my first time on this committee, so some of the the terminology I'm not familiar with. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. One thing, probably about a year ago, I had to pick up an airplane in Aurora, and I flew up to about Day Road, and I turned and flew across some of the aggregate facilities, headed off to that would be west-northwest. And I was paralleling the power lines going out towards Six Corners. And I noticed when I turned, because what I was trying to do was envision the West Side Freeway, the bypass. And What I did is I came up against the hills that would be the backside of Beaverton, that range that's right, you know, that's to the west of Beaverton, and I noticed there were many aggregate mines through there. That's an area of tremendous growth. How are those mines as far as the quantity that's still available? Any idea on those? Maybe we could, if you don't have them, get us an idea. Because one of the thoughts that we had was, what a beautiful coincidence to have a highway needing to be built with all of these sources of rock all the way along the length of it. And of course,
absolutely,
the idea being is that if you've got a road built like that, you then would also have the ability to move that aggregate product, you know, in on that highway system.
That's correct.
So get us a report on that. I was a little bit concerned. It looked like it was some of our heavily mined, getting fairly deep. And is there a study of where we are in relationship to the amount of rock that's going to be forecast to be?
Yes, needed? I believe there is. We've got it forecast to 2060.
Okay.
And I can get that information for you.
Right. That would be very valuable if that's not a big problem.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Now, we are city folks ready to go?
I think that the mayor just arrived.
Did that mayor arrive? All right. Andrea? Have you guys come on up? Oh, yes, the mayor is here. Hey, I was just talking about you.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm fine.
You notice I took that road that I was describing around your city? Okay, didn't go through it.
Well, it's impossible to go through it many times. Particularly when you're trying to get down to Salem quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. While we recognize that this is a general government transportation committee, there are obviously lots of issues that impact cities. We have sat down individually and talked with you about some of the league's priorities, but today we're going to focus on the transportation side of things, especially in light of some of the work groups that you've established to talk about transportation issues. We are in the process of updating some of this information, and so this is the most current data that we have in terms of transportation facts and statistics in the presentation. On my right, I have with me Lou Ogden, the mayor of Tualatin, and he is also the vice chair of the league's board of directors. And on my left, I have with me Pierre Fernandez, the transportation services manager for the city of Salem. And he's going to get into some technical issues, but I'll let Lou start off.
Well, again, Chair, Senator George, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Well,
Senator Carter, pleased to meet you. As to echo what Andrea said, first of all, we do appreciate you taking the time to visit with us a little bit here today and let us give you some of our thoughts with regard to transportation. And obviously, this is not a new issue for any of us here today. And it's not a particularly easy issue, but I guess let me just kind of take a couple steps back from where we were a couple years ago, last session, and just try to put things into context as we see it from cities. And let me just begin with the mission statement of cities from the standpoint, and you have that on the first slide if you have that material in front of you. And is that been passed out?
Okay.
Momentary technical delay. But our mission statement is simple. It's to strengthen and support the livability of communities. And your comment about congestion in Tualatin is an example of a notion that is not consistent with a livable community, obviously. But the notion of livable communities is something that we struggle with individually to balance sometimes expanding a transportation facility in order to provide more traffic to go through it, or closing things down to try to have traffic go around it or be more pedestrian friendly or whatever. The answer isn't always just adding more lanes of transportation thoroughfares, but it is always addressing transportation, where people are trying to go, where they're trying to get from, where they're trying to get to, with respect to the context of keeping vibrant downtowns and livable communities. I want to just kind of make another comment about cities in that with respect to economic development and prosperity and the vitality in the state of Oregon, the vast majority of the population increase over the last decade, and I think Peter has the details, has occurred inside city limits. Now, with one respect, it's because city limits have been expanding, of course, and urban growth boundaries in some cases have been expanding. But just want to draw the corollary to the fact that as growth and development occurs, it occurs inside cities largely. And what that means is two things. It means that our demand on services is much greater, but it also means the revenue generated to the state, vis-a-vis the income tax, the growth in revenues that come to the state of Oregon come because of the infrastructure that cities put in place. And, of course, a large component of that infrastructure is our transportation system. We are constantly battling, and even more so battling the balance between trying to expand facilities to allow more throughput and try to maintain facilities, the dollars it takes to maintain roadbeds and potholes and that sort of thing. And the third piece is try to, quote unquote, and this is an overused term, but manage growth in such a way that we aren't continually just dumping more and more cars onto the connection between home and work. I think I would like to pass at this moment over to Peter and let Peter go through some of the specifics of road miles, of need, of population growth, things that you've reviewed, Chair George, and obviously the last couple sessions, but the story continues to get louder, I guess I would say.
Thank you. My name is Peter Fernandez, a transportation services manager with the City of Salem and a member of the League of Oregon Cities Transportation Committee, and I'm here in that capacity today as a member of the committee. What I'd like to do today is this piece that Andrea passed out really provides the complete story of what we want to do today. So what I'd like to do is just kind of highlight a couple of the slides that are in there, and I'll hold them up so you can see which ones I'm talking about. And what I want to do is begin with just kind of three themes that I want to leave with you. The first is that the cities are the owners of a very large percentage of the transportation system, and we're in fact the owners and operators of the system. Second, the city's transportation system is perhaps the most complex of all of the transportation systems that we have in the state. And finally, the city's transportation system is in a funding crisis, and you know, we'd be silly to come before a transportation committee and not mention that. And I think we all know that we're always in need, and we've been at this for quite a while. Let me elaborate a little bit on each one of these. I think throughout the session you'll hear from all of the transportation stakeholders. These are all important voices. All the stakeholders have issues, have needs. We're the same. But remember that there are only a few owners. Well, there are many stakeholders, there are only a few owners, and we are, as I mentioned, in fact, the owners of a very large percentage of the system. Just some statistics, and I think this one, this increased mile slide presents that. Cities own over 8,300 miles of streets and over 500 bridges. As the mayor mentioned, commensurate with the population growth, we've had a tremendous increase in vehicle miles of travel inside the city. And our mileage, when you think about it, every time a new subdivision comes in, our mileage increases because all of those miles are now our miles. They're very rarely the county's miles. They're never the state's miles. They're almost always the city's miles. So this is now additional inventory that we have to maintain, an additional inventory that the population travels on. It's interesting to note that the travel on city streets has grown at a much faster rate than the population has, and that's just because people just do a lot of stuff. You know, the whole soccer mom phenomenon that was talked about a few years ago, people don't just go from home to work and back again. There are numerous trips to the playground, to the university, to the colleges, to hobbies, et cetera. So, and all of that puts a tremendous burden on our street system.
Peter, you may have seen that number that I compiled last session. It was from the governor's growth study, 18% population growth, but almost 60% increase
right.
from VMT.
Right.
Indicating just exactly what you're
right.
saying is happening.
Right. Next thing I want to talk about is complexity. By their very nature, city streets are very complex. They are diverse. We have a diverse and interconnected system. We provide the infrastructure, the basis for all modes of travel, walking, bicycling, public transit. all of those run on the public streets, on the city street system. We have thousands of signs marking signals. We usually have street lighting that we maintain. We have not just what's on the surface and above the surface, but what's below, the utilities, the storm drainage, water and sewer all runs on city rights of way. And we have a wide variety of users. In fact, virtually all users of the transportation system use the city streets. We construct, we maintain, we operate a variety of facilities. So we not only have arterials that are typically are multi-lane, but we have alleys, we have city streets, and all of that is part of what we do and adds to the complexity of the work that we have to do. Because of that complexity, this pie chart shows a summary of how the money is spent. And it's important to remember, there's always a lot of talk about the capital costs, you know, the needs due to capital, but our biggest need is actually just maintaining and operating the system. And I just want to talk a little bit about what operating and maintaining the system is, and I have a little list of traffic engineering and transportation planning, maintaining the pavement, patching the potholes, maintaining the striping, the markings, the signs, the signals, maintaining the shoulders, the gutters, the guardrail, fencing, sweeping, mowing, trimming the trees, collecting and disposing of roadkill. You know, that's something that we have to do with our money. So de-icing, which if you're commuting in Salem, you'll see that my crews are doing a great job of spreading the de-icer in advance of the – we'll see how we do tomorrow. So I think it's going to be a problem. And paying the electric bill, you know, the
not tomorrow. I understand we're going to have to see about it when I go to Portland this afternoon.
Right along.
Hey, you need to hit your ride. My car doesn't navigate all the snow.
We're paying ourselves together as we hit them.
Well, we can use the bed tax if you stay here, so. And finally, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, no presentation is complete from a city without talking a little bit about our funding issues. And we're not here asking for money today, but I just want to, you know, set the stage for you a little bit. You know, the first thing I want to say is that the cities, in cooperation with the counties and the state, have and continue to find ways to become more efficient. We at the City of Salem have partnerships with ODOT Region 2, with ODOT District 3, with Marion County, with Polk County, with the City of Kaiser. You know, we have our maintenance people have meetings constantly at the beginning of the year to, you know, what are we going to do for each other this year? We find all kinds of ways to do things. We trade equipment. So we've picked that fruit and continue to improve in that area. So we've come long ways in the efficiency area. Cities raise over half of our budgets, of our transportation budgets. I'll tell you that the state gas tax allocation to cities is typically a good percentage, but not the largest percentage. We collect SDCs. We use general fund money on occasions, franchise fees, which cities are able to collect, and a lot of that is used for maintaining and operating the street system. And finally, and I'm sure, Senators, you've seen this graph, my favorite graph, of if you don't spend a dollar today, you'll spend $4 tomorrow.
I used that in the road levy in 1977. No, 1987.
Well, and unfortunately, yeah, if it didn't go well, we're down here now. And that's really important, and that really holds true. And what we want to do is, if we're able to spend money, we don't even want to keep our roads at very good. If we can just keep them above fair, we can spend the money, and if we do it in a perpetual life way, if we spend a little bit every few years, we can really extend that line out. Once we let them go below the fair line and get into poor, then we can't just do the simple stuff anymore. Now we really are into removing that pavement, removing that that aggregate, replacing it, and starting from scratch, rebuilding the street again. And it's not a very efficient way of doing business. So with that, I thank you for your time. And
I would like to, if I may, just kind of piggyback on the comment of complexity that Peter made with regard to our streets. And the notion here isn't to come and cry on your shoulder as much it is to sort of kind of paint the picture. When you expand a state highway or even a county road, and I'm not going to in any way imply that the city streets are more important, But when you make those expansions, it's largely right-of-way and asphalt and shoulders and probably some bridges to cross some waterways, et cetera, and maybe, you know, an interchange or access connection. When you expand a city street, we're talking not only the lanes of traffic, but we're talking about the curbing, the sidewalks, the bicycle lanes, in many cases, signalization that maybe wasn't there or needs to be upgraded. If you just visualize in your own mind a state highway or county road and then a city street and think of all the components of that street that are more than just the travel lanes. So it makes the cost per mile, the cost per foot, becomes so much more expensive. And just kind of anecdotally, to give you a point, case in point, and Senator George, I'm sure you're familiar by Tualatin High School where Graham's Ferry comes in to Boone's Ferry. And then there's a residential street that kind of comes in at a very acute angle. And as we look at just improving that intersection up there by the high school, we wanted to put a signal in. Signalization alone is about $200,000, give or take, and Peter can correct me on the specifics, but that's about what it costs. By the time we realign the intersection there so that people didn't have to look back over their right-hand shoulder to try to make what should be a T-intersection and add the signalization, the crosswalk for the kids to get to the school, the bicycle lanes that should have been there, no sidewalks were there, all that, it was basically two phases of $1.25 million one phase and $1.5 million the next phase. Now, the answer is, or I mean, the response could be, well, you could have just hung the signal, and that's true, we could have. But because of the safety issues, the expansion, these were farm-to-market roads from 50 or 60 years ago, now they're downtown. I create that story only to tell you that as we look at how do you manage traffic and provide more capacity, it is in cities much more broad than simply just adding more travel lanes, and the costs just become formidable. And then lastly, we just had a city council meeting Monday night, and we were talking about our next year's budget. And in Tualatin, and I use Tualatin because it's kind of a good little microcosm of many cities in Oregon. We've got some new, we've got some old, we have state facilities, county facilities, and city facilities all in one little town of 20,000 people. And our city manager and our city engineer was telling us that this is the first year, the next coming budget year, where we will be budgeting for no expansion or modernization or safety improvements because 100% of all the money that we have will have to go into maintenance. And you think about Tualatin, we got a lot of new streets, but we're talking about our older streets and so on. So it is just kind of a collage, I guess, of all the different components that you see in probably any city in Oregon in one form or another. These are becoming desperate times. And that leads into the whole notion of how do we connect with our voters? When the voters said something like 88 to 12, we don't want to pay any more money. And yet we have, you know, in our town, neighbors coming and saying our kids shouldn't cross a busy road without a signal to get to school. We shouldn't have to put up with this traffic. We should be able to get down to Safeway easier. And the story goes on and on and on. We're struggling with how to get folks to understand that to be able to do these things, there are costs associated with it, and it isn't free. So with that very rosy backdrop, I guess to the extent that we can, in the future, and appreciate the time today probably running out, dialogue about how we collectively, the state, the cities, and the counties, can connect our voters into saying that, you know, when you go to the movie, you expect to pay $8 to get in. When you get in your car to drive, you expect to pay nothing. Why is that? And is that real life? I don't have an answer, but I propose the question.
Well, it's a great point, and that's why we're going to probably stir up a lot of dust when the work group goes to work on alternative funding sources for roads. But we've all come to the same conclusion that we're behind the curve, and I don't like that graph either, because it is a real graph relative to the, if you don't maintain to a certain level, you get to rebuild completely. This one right here, an increased use, I wanted to ask a question about this because I think it may be what you're relating to. And what I noticed was is that this is 1982, and of course we have 1997. I see a lot of major increase in minor arterials, and what I wanted to ask you a question is, I'm suspecting that what's happening as the major collectors are becoming maximum capacity, they've reached that capacity level, and then you haven't been able to actually maintain them or increase their capacity, that you're literally shifting traffic to the minor arterials. Is that what you guys think is happening?
Well, our neighborhood sure think that.
The neighbors think, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and a good part of that, too, is, and Peter helped me here with the details, you build a new cul-de-sac or a residential area or even a high-density area, townhouses or whatever, then you're expanding the local streets to obviously put the front streets in front of those buildings, and you may not have to expand the arterials accordingly. And the other piece of it is that because we do collect system development charges and other pieces to help fund the arterials, that is, like, at least in Washington County, that's a little over 25% of the cost. So even though we're collecting a pot of money to maybe build new arterials or widen them, at 25 cents on the dollar, we aren't able to get there. But yet the developer has to put in the new street before they can put houses on it. So it's both an increase in new streets and, of course, and as you say, the cut-through traffic is also an issue because it's like water, path of least resistance.
Well, you guys may want to stick around and hear about scooters. I mean, it might be we could subsidize everybody ride them.
Sounds good to me.
Well, I can guarantee you, Mr. Chairman, that they're on a city street.
What we're going to hear is that they're not supposed to be. Any questions? Well, thank you all very, very much. And keep us informed. I know you'll be watching what we're doing. We are going to be working on some rather creative ideas. And in fact, we're going to have more committee bill introductions that are kind of placeholders for some ideas we're working on. So stay tuned, and we're committed to try to address some of these concerns. Because I, as a person who has been involved with roads and road committees for a number of years, my thought is we are moving backwards.
Well, we appreciate that, and we are anxious to participate in alternative funding mechanisms, other ways to help people understand you got to pay to play. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead at this point and close the informational meeting, and I'm going to open a work session with possible introduction. Well, we are going to introduce committee bills. With that, I will open that work system session. Patrick, you want to read these for us real quick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Legislative Concept 3147 relating to trails to the shore of the Pacific Ocean and declaring an emergency. Legislative Concept 3148 relating to the use of state highway fund monies in recreation areas and declaring an emergency. Legislative Concept 3289 relating to flat fee rates.
Okay. We have probably another group of these coming. Some of these will never see the light of day. Others, in fact, may become the vehicle for, you know, for some programs. Without objection.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt these drafts, LC drafts, as committee bills.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, without objection. Thank you. Okay. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing. And are we prepared at this point to deal with Senate Bill 323?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe we are.
Okay. If everyone is here, then we're going to open up a public hearing with a possible work session on Senate Bill 323. Patrick, tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 323 defines rail fixed guideway systems. It includes rail fixed guideway system and motor vehicle offenses. It requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to establish a safety program for all municipal corporations operating rail fixed guideway systems and requires the local government to pay a fee to cover ODOT's costs to operate the program. It also repeals the definition of trolley. Oregon statute currently includes references to trolley, streetcars, light and heavy rail systems, and monorails. Senate Bill 323 brings all of these systems, plus inclined plane, funicular, and automated guideways under one definition. ODOT currently operates the federally mandated Rail Fixed Guideway Safety Oversight Program. Currently, by agreement, TriMet reimburses ODOT for the cost of this program. However, this reimbursement does not cover all costs associated with operating the program, and fees paid by freight railroads are used to fund the shortfall. Under Senate Bill 323, ODOT would be given authority to set the fee administratively at a level that would cover all the costs of operating the program. There is no revenue impact for Senate Bill 323. A fiscal impact statement has been issued, which indicates that there would be a roughly $300,000 biennial transfer from local governments to the Oregon Department of Transportation for the operation of this program.
Okay, and who do we have that's going to speak to us first?
Our first testifier is Ms. Claudia Howes from the ODOT Rail Section.
Claudia, welcome.
Thank you, Chair George. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I am Claudia Howes. I manage ODOT's rail division. Patrick did a really nice job of explaining the bill. What I might do, and I assume you have the bill before you, is give you a little bit of the background and how we ended up identifying the problem. On the face of it, particularly the part where we have changed such terms as streetcar and trolley to what I consider to be a really awful term because I can't ever get it right, rail fixed guideway system. In some ways, it's kind of sad because it's taking some rather romantic terms out of the statutes and replacing it with a highly bureaucratic one. But there is actually a functional reason for doing that. We had a couple things happen that brought a problem to our attention. One of them, questions from school bus drivers about how to behave at crossings of the MAX line. Was that, in fact, a highway railroad crossing, and were they supposed to stop? The second one actually came about from someone who for years worked for DMV and who, when I was staffing this committee, I worked with in revising the motor vehicle code, and probably respect more than almost anybody around in terms of her knowledge of the vehicle laws. She was working as a retired employee on the driver's manual and brought to our attention the fact that there was an absence of direction for certain kinds of vehicles, particularly school buses, in how they should behave at these kinds of crossings. When we took a hard look at that, we realized that that was indeed true, worked with legislative counsel to go through the statutes and identify terms like trolley and streetcar and make it very clear within the statutes that if there are tracks in the road, and there is another road crossing them. This, by the way, is not where the system is street running, such as a streetcar in Portland, but where you actually have separated railroad right-of-way with a road crossing it. At that point, we really don't want a school bus driver to have to judge what the vehicle is on the tracks, but to act as if there is a train there, no matter what kind of train it is. So the first part of the bill addresses that that problem, and as I said, unfortunately replaces it with a term that is the federal definition of that list of what I guess I would call non-traditional railroad technology, those things that are not your typical railroad. By the way, this does not include the high-speed rail system, which is under the jurisdiction of the Federal Railroad Administration. It also does not include commuter rail, but is quite specific to light rail, streetcar operations, and I think I've provided a list of other operations that fall under this, one of them being the Astoria Trolley, another being the Willamette Valley Shore Trolley that is operated or owned by the City of Lake Oswego. The second part, which also Patrick explained very well, is the fact that we currently are responsible for the Federal Transit Administration mandated program for a safety oversight program. And I might mention the difference between an oversight program and a regulatory program is that the oversight program has no penalty or enforcement provisions, but it's rather, I guess I would call it a partnership relationship where we use our expertise to guide them in developing their rules and their operating practices, and that those are actually blessed by the FTA. But unlike our regulatory programs and those of the FRA over the freight railroads and actually over Amtrak, there is no enforcement responsibility. This may change ultimately. This is a new program for the FTA and for us, but at the moment that does not exist. Some of our new and coming online rail transit operations, among them the Portland streetcar operation, the new little trolley operation in Astoria, do not have any federal money in them, so therefore do not fall under the FTA program. Under current law, they are actually railroads. We don't really want to treat them as railroads. We would rather treat them as we do TriMet, with an oversight program rather than a regulatory program. So this takes those operations and essentially treats them the same way. In addition to that, because we currently don't really have a permanent funding mechanism, we are reimbursed We, in fact, went into this program without any additional budget authority. We are proposing to establish a fee by rule, handled very much like we do the fee on railroads, with the distinguishing feature being that we will only charge them the cost of the very, and it's going to be 1.2 FTE that actually work on that part of the program, and they will pay the full cost of the program itself, because it is true that we are not recovering full cost now, which means the program is being subsidized by the fee assessed on the freight railroads, which they would, I'm sure, prefer not to do, and which actually is legally questionable. So those are the basic elements of the bill, and if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Claudia, those folks who are going to be regulated, mainly, I guess we're talking about TriMet, what is their feeling about this? I know you were negotiating with them. Can you bring us up to speed as to where that relationship has arrived?
We've of course, talked to TriMet about this. I think they're just like anybody else. They don't want to pay any more money than they have to. But I think they understand that we can't have another part of the railroad industry paying for what we do for them. I think they also appreciate that if you have a permanent program, reimbursement is a rather awkward way to do it. It causes some other kind of funny things in the way you handle your accounting system. I think they also, we have a very good relationship with them, so I think they value what we do. If we did not do the program, they would chance to, or stand to lose 5% of their federal funding. So we have to do the program. They want us to do the program. It's simply a matter of them paying for it. We don't overcharge. As you may remember from my presentation, our whole railroad safety program is under $2.5 million. Their portion will be very small, and $300,000 is probably a high estimate.
Questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Carney.
Under comments to this bill to require local government to pay a fee to the Department of Transportation to operate, we're not getting into any situation of mandates.
Mandates. That was.
That's the concern I have. That they have an agreement they want to consider this to be a mandate in which the legislature should cover the cost of the.
Chair George, Senator Clarno, it's an interesting question. In terms of a mandate, at this point, if we don't move those operations into this oversight category, they are by net definition railroads. And under current law, we would charge them based on their gross operating revenue. And we would actually regulate them fully with enforcement power and all of that other stuff. I don't think that that's a mandate. I think that's simply something that they fall under now. We currently have three publicly owned railroads that are, you know, certificated by the Surface Transportation Board. We charge them like we do Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe. So I think that that would not cover that.
Claudia, if I understand what you're saying, that they, with the gross revenue figure, you'd probably be talking about a lot more money than the maximum $300,000 or so.
Chair George, you know, I would guess that could be very likely if we did it based on gross revenue. I have no idea what TriMet's gross revenue is, but my guess is that would be substantial even if you subtracted the federal money. So you're right, it would be more.
Okay. Claudia, thank you. Right now, Claudia was the only person signed up to testify on this, but I'm sure there must be more interest than just the one presenter. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 323?
Lose the bet.
Okay, I think so. All right. Ready to go to work, sir?
Yeah, I think so. Mr. Chair,
hang on, let me go ahead and
vote.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 323.
Mr. Chair.
Question before the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay, it's been moved that Senate Bill 323 be sent to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Senator
discussion.
Carter.
Senator Carter, did you feel reasonably comfortable that under the circumstances, it's actually a requirement from the federal government, is not considered a mandate from the city?
I guess the comments section is what troubled me. This bill would require local governments to pay a fee to cover the Department of Transportation costs. I don't see that exact wording in the bill. So I don't know if that's comments or fiscal analysis.
Claudia, could you come back up?
Question on behalf of Senator Carno's question on the paper. Define the difference between what is expected from the federal government and the explanation on this as being a fee.
Chair George, Senator Carter, I may have to backtrack a little bit. The program, the safety oversight program over TriMet, is mandated by the federal government. By the way, an unfunded mandate to us. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want to make sure we're doing to somebody else. We don't want to pass
it along here.
We don't want to do what the federal government does.
We are, by the way, working to get the FTA to pay it for at least part of that program. But, you know, that takes time. We have to do the FTA program for TriMet. They lose federal money if they don't comply. So therefore, what they would lose would be significantly more than what they pay us.
Okay.
As far as the other operations, that would be a state-only program at present. We don't know where the FTA is going with this. However, the choice is they become a railroad.
Mr. Chairman,
mm-hmm.
Senator Carno, I think that they'd much rather have to pay this little fee than to lose all of the dollars.
I think I'm comfortable now.
Okay.
Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
have we had any indication from TriMet, verbal, written, or anything, whether they're neutral? Have they been notified? Are they aware?
Notified, yes. Patrick, any response?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. They were notified, and we have not received any response from TriMet on this measure.
And believe you me, they would have called me.
Well, that is my assumption also.
Somewhere between now or here and the other end of this building, I'm sure between now and then they would call if they are interested.
That's right.
They might have found us by now.
That's right.
This sounds like one of those things that, or forever hold your peace.
That's right.
Okay, is there any further discussion? All right. I'm going to go ahead and ask that we cast a vote on this. And so let's do that at this time.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Carno?
Aye.
Senator Mazzoli?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Chair George?
Aye. Senate Bill 323 has been passed and will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do anyone would like to carry it? If not, I will do that.
I'll carry it.
You want to carry it? Okay. Then you can reflect if you have heard anything about it.
That's right.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 323. And I'm going to open a public hearing and combine two bills together since they're very similar. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173 and 451. Patrick, tell us where we are. We have what I'd like to do, if possible, we're going to have the senator speak first.
Yep.
And then we will go to the proponents of the measure and then we'll get the other.
Okay. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 173 defines motor-assisted scooter, adds motor-assisted scooter to electric-assisted bicycle laws. Oregon Vehicle Code does not presently define the motor-assisted scooter or provide a legal framework in which to operate a scooter. In the absence of a clear definition, motor-assisted scooters have been treated as motor vehicles, subject to laws that govern motor vehicles. There is no present legal authority to operate motor-assisted scooters on roadways due to the lack of required safety-related equipment. However, both electric and gas-powered scooters are presently sold and operated within Oregon, even in the absence of legal authority. Senate Bill 451 defines electric-assisted scooter and adds electric-assisted scooter to electric-assisted bicycle laws. And if I may take a moment, Mr. Chairman, what I've done is a side-by-side analysis of these two bills because they're very similar. And Senate Bill 173, if you look at the short matrix here, you'll see that Senate Bill 173 relates to motor-assisted scooters, and Senate Bill 451 relates to electric assisted scooters. I've bolded where there are differences. Under Senate Bill 173, under the definition of a motor-assisted scooter, it includes gas motorized scooters, whereas that's not included under the electric-assisted scooter definition. The maximum speed limit to qualify as a motor-assisted scooter is 24 miles per hour, and for electric-assisted scooter, it is 20 miles per hour. Also, under Senate Bill 451, the electric-assisted scooter bill, it also includes a maximum power unit of not more than 1,000 watts. Under motor vehicle traffic offenses, under Senate Bill 451, a person commits the offense of failure of a motor vehicle operator to yield to a rider on a bicycle lane. The person does not yield to an electric-assisted scooter. And under Senate Bill 173, there is no such provision. As far as the similarities, with regard to mopeds and electric bicycles, and also bicycles, it clearly specifies that under the Oregon Vehicle Code, motor-assisted and electric-assisted scooters are not to be. Actually, under moped and electric bicycle, it says that motor scooters and electric scooters are not mopeds or electric-assisted bicycles. With regard to bicycles, a motor-assisted scooter and electric-assisted scooter is considered a bicycle for the purposes of Oregon vehicle codes. And then also with regard to operation on a sidewalk, it specifies that a motor-assisted scooter may not be operated on a sidewalk, and it results in a Class D traffic violation, which I believe is a $75 ticket.
Are we ready for Senator Brown?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7, and I am here on behalf of Senate Bill 451, which was a constituent request, and I have no pride of authorship, so if the committee wishes to combine these two bills, that would be fine with me. I think the committee staff pointed out the details. It's a fairly straightforward bill allowing for electric scooters to go on city streets. I think there are a couple of issues that we do need to address. I do think it's important that we limit the use of the electric scooter on streets that don't go in excess of 35 or 25 miles per hour. Again, I would defer to law enforcement what they think is appropriate. It may be 35 miles per hour may be appropriate. Also, Senate Bill 451 does not limits it to the for those use for those 16 years of age and older. And colleagues, it may be appropriate for all ages to use these. I frankly haven't been on one, so I don't know how dangerous they are. But if the committee would like to not put an age limit on it, I would encourage the committee to look at requiring helmets for those younger than 16 years of age to match with our bicycle helmet law. So anyway, I would certainly be open to have any discussions on that. But otherwise, I would certainly appreciate your support on both of these issues. The difference between the two essentially is the electric is the pollution, doesn't have the pollution that the gas motorized vehicle would have. And I don't know what the noise level is between the two. I'm getting signals from the committee chair that they're great. So anyway, it's great for livability issues, traffic congestion. My understanding is that folks use them to get around to the grocery store, run errands. You have in your packets letters from a variety of folks. My understanding is that they're using them to get around downtown Portland to run errands, to go catch the bus, make sure you're on time for the bus. So very handy. The smaller ones you apparently can just fold up and take with you. So I don't think either one of those you can quite fold up. But thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate the committee time on this issue.
Senator, we don't have the packets yet, but we'll have them in
okay.
a few minutes.
Okay, great. I do know that City Commissioner Charlie Hales is supportive of both bills and would like to make sure that the committee passes one or both of them.
Senator Farnham.
Yes, I would like to have one of these for going down the hall in the Capitol. I could perhaps arrive here on time. I'm always late for this meeting because I have another one that runs till 3, and I could just really buzz down there. But I hope these aren't as easy to wreck as the smaller ones. It was reported in the paper this summer that there were 4,000 accidents on the smaller ones, and actually there were 4,001 accidents. I just didn't report mine. Borrowed my grandson's scooter and really crashed and burned. First time I put my teeth through my lip in a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
Was not fun.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, I would assume these are less
yes.
dangerous from the both skateboards and the regular scooters, having watched my stepson on his scooter and his skateboard recently go up and down our steps. So my guess is these are a little bit safer.
One more comment. I noticed the one has lighting, I assume, front and back, because I can see a little taillight back there. Does the other scooter have lighting front? I don't see one in the front.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. It does.
It can. Mr.
Okay.
Chair, Senator Carno, it can have lighting. So
that seems like that'd be very important. They are pretty small.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, yes. And also, another thought, you could use these for rounding up cattle or pigs in appropriate places where you have the bike paths to do so. So
that's an excellent idea. Thank you very much.
Well, Senator, as my back has been bothering me the last 2 days, I was thinking, you know, we may need to, we were checking the relating clause just a second ago to see if it could be related to scooters in the Capitol building, so both of us would be able to benefit.
That's great.
You ride too fast. That's not a Harley.
Chair, are you planning on going to work session on this today?
Well, what we're talking about is what the Senator just described, and that's the possibility of combining the two bills, because I think there's good things on both sides of the ledger. That's why I asked Patrick if he could do this for us. So I think what we'll do is that may require amendments, and we're not doing that again. And so we'll see how it goes.
Well, Mr. Chair, my reason for asking, I'd like to see if I can get 24 miles an hour before I vote on this.
You cannot. I had it in low range. It's very slow. You're gonna hear testimony as to the maximum speeds of these vehicles, and you'll have to be going downhill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, committee members.
Patrick, who's next on the list?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next testifier is John Geffen from Ron Tonkin Dealerships. John is, of course, the man who brought the scooters.
Come on up. You have someone with you, too, or a helper? Or? Okay.
Good.
John, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for letting me ride. By the way, I have to put on the record that I did do that with the permission of the state police, or if they turned their back is what they actually did.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senator George, Senator Carno, Senator Messerly, and committee members. I am here to urge your support of Senate Bills number 173 and 451 relating to gas and electric-assisted scooters. My name is John Geffen, and I'm General Manager of Ron Tonkin's Alternative Fuel Vehicle Division. We're the only automobile dealership in the country, in the United States, that has an alternative fuel vehicle division that specializes in no-emission vehicles, super ultra-low-emission vehicles, according to CARB, and small, light transportation. My stores sell a large variety of electric-assisted bicycles and scooters, and they are both electric and gas-assisted. Electric and gas-assisted scooters fit poorly into our established motor vehicle categories. The poor fit has created a situation in which riders are unsure of the rules they must follow, and local police find it hard to enforce the existing laws. Unless the legislature acts, riders will operate them unlawfully, while law enforcement remains unable to effectively enforce the rules. There are so many of them being sold and so many of them on the road today. Specifically, the contemplated Senate bills will change the Oregon Vehicle Code to 1. Properly classify the scooters under the existing statutes for electric-assisted bicycles, and set forth the rules of operation for riders. And I'm grateful to those members that supported those for electric-assisted bicycles. Today, our customers are no longer breaking the law when they go out to ride their bicycle. The surge of consumer interest in these scooters are exactly the sort of new alternative transportation that we ought to encourage. The electric-assisted scooters are completely clean and reduce traffic congestion on our streets and alleviate parking problems. They're energy efficient, economical to operate, and environmentally correct. The more people who use them, the cleaner our air will be and the quieter our streets will be. But the laws as they now exist are tough on people who may be considering using them. As you can plainly see, these scooters are nothing like a moped or motorcycle. Yet under Oregon law, these are technically considered a moped or motorcycle. The requirements for moped use are a lot more stringent than they need be for this type of vehicle and a lot more restrictive. If I wanted to take this scooter on public streets to the grocery store, I would have to run out and find some method of registering a scooter that has no classification and an insurance carrier that has no idea how to characterize the scooter. All of this adds up to the smothering of a brand new industry that has tremendous potential. What Senate Bill 173 and Senate Bill 451 does is set these scooters in the category where they belong. To avoid confusion, I encourage the committee to consider merging the two proposed bills. Chair George, I'd like to continue with some excerpts from some supporting letters of individuals that were unable to be here.
That would be great. I'm reading some of them right now.
From the Commissioner, City of Portland, Charlie Hales. I am writing to express my support for Senate Bills 173 and 451 regarding the regulation of motorized scooters. As the Portland City Commissioner in charge of the Portland Office of Transportation, I am keenly aware of the need for responsible regulation of motorized scooters in the public right-of-way. I am happy to see your committee address the need for our state and local laws to catch up with the latest developments in the 21st century transportation. The City of Portland works hard to encourage and facilitate the use of alternatives to the automobile. Our ongoing need to prevent air pollution and fight traffic congestion requires this effort. Alternative transportation of all sorts, skates, bicycles, buses, light rail, streetcars, and scooters are all legitimate and useful complements to cars, trucks, and motorcycles. However, presently there are no coherent rules or regulations concerning the use of motorized scooters in the public right-of-way. I have before me a letter signed by Lee Iacocca, founder and chairman of EV Global Motors Incorporated. On behalf of EV Motors Company, Inc., I am writing you an enthusiastic support of Oregon's Senate Bills 451 and 173. These bills will increase use of alternative transportation in the environmentally friendly state of Oregon. You have copies of this letter to follow. From Peter Rupi, Vice President of Global Equipment for Nike Incorporated. The use of an electric scooter has been a solid benefit for me. I use it primarily to move from office building to office building. It is easy to manage with regard to pedestrian traffic and is a safe and clean mode of transportation. As a person that commutes 10 miles to work close to 100 days per year, the scooter is a great complement in trying to minimize my use of an automobile. Two, you'll notice some letters from other constituents. You'll notice some support from manufacturers. And one that I'm would like to take a few more moments from Tinker Hatfield, Vice President of Design and Special Projects, Nike Incorporated. I'm an enthusiastic supporter of alternative transportation. I currently own 3 Zappy electric scooters. These scooters are two-wheeled motorized, stand-on-top vehicles that travel at a maximum speed of 10 to 12 miles per hour on level ground. I live in northeast Portland and can ride my scooter to the Lloyd District MAX station light rail in about 7 minutes. I fold up the scooter and ride the light rail train to the Merlo station in Beaverton and then proceed to unfold the scooter and ride another 7 minutes to my place of work at the Nike World headquarters. The entire trip takes about an hour and requires no bus rides or transfers. From the Clean Cities Coalition, National Clean Cities Coalition, from the Columbia-Willamette region, of which I'm also a member of the Board of Directors, the Columbia-Willamette Clean Cities Coalition is pleased to announce that we support Oregon Senate bills. We see this as another step in enhancing the utilization of alternative transportation and cleaner fuels. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair George and committee members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Senator Besselman.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question in regards to both bills. As I read this, the way they're drafted, not more than two wheels can be on the ground at a time, and I see we have a three-wheeler out here. Do we need to make an amendment to the bills? And I would assume you could have...
May I respond?
Four wheels, too, correct?
May I respond? Yes.
Yes.
We have many senior citizens that come in, or people that are somewhat handicapped and are not ready for a medical scooter, and yet they need some mobility to get around. These scooters here are a fraction of what a medical scooter would cost them. And we often find that doctors and places like the VA are willing to, vocational rehab as well, are willing to foot the bill for these scooters for their clients. Some of them do, one of them in the booklet has four wheels on it. There's three in the back, one in the front for additional stability. This is a three-wheel version of it. Chair George.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I want to explain. Sir, I'm not opposing the bill at all. It's just I think it needs to be redrafted. There's a technical matter in the bill.
As you were describing this, I was thinking about that ability of that thing to deliver you to the light rail line, which has been a problem, you know, bus system, so on. Portland is... modified a lot of streets to increase, to provide large capacity bike lanes. And you, if you think about this from the standpoint of being able to enhance transit, you know, it is not going, particularly the electrics, they're not going to be burning, you know, petroleum products. What kind of mileage are we talking about here, by the way? Let's ask that question first.
On a single charge, some of these can get up to 18 miles on a single charge. And, regarding the emissions from gas power, the new scooters are being made with small catalytics and extended mufflers to lower the noise and emissions ranges also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, this is a philosophy question that I'll ask you. You know, there's as we looked for ways to get people around, especially as congestion goes, and we come up with ideas of bicycles and providing an opportunity for them to, with our bicycle lanes and others, to, you know, move people differently so that they're not all in their cars, and the scooter can perhaps be another alternative for that. But we also hear that there is you know, a real concern among citizens, that I know we all hear too, that the dollars that build this infrastructure that come from the gas tax, you know, should go to the roads, and yet the roads are used by other multimodal transports that are not paying any contribution to building that infrastructure. I was just curious as to your philosophy as to those with scooters or bicycles. Do you think there's any obligation on those users to pay for any of the infrastructure that is utilized by those other vehicles?
Senator George, Chair George, Senator Metzger, I don't know the answer.
I just wanted your opinion.
Because
I don't get to ask to speak for Ron.
Sure.
I was just seeing what you think.
To set up an infrastructure to register bicycles, electric bicycles, and scooters is a whole business that I know nothing about.
And I just philosophically, I mean, should other users, you know, should there be fees for that?
I don't think so.
Your buddy says no. So. Okay. I mean, I just think, Mr. Chair, that is that's just one of the issues that, you know, and you hear about that often too. And
sure.
And as in, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this isn't a wonderful idea, but as we succeed in getting more and more people to use different modes of transportation, and then those users demand more infrastructure access to utilize those, then we're faced with the decision, how are you going to pay for those wider roads for bike lanes or for scooter lanes or whatever may come? And it's just something that that we have to, I think about going forward.
Senator Carmichael.
I just would add to that that I get a lot of letters or a lot of comments at town hall meetings.
Why aren't we why are we using highway gas tax dollars to build bike lanes? Mm-hmm. And I think we all know bike lanes are necessary for safety issues for people who choose to use that mode of transportation. But we do get a lot of requests of why we don't charge them either a fee at purchase time or a licensing fee. So I know we've all received those.
Yeah, I've raised that question myself. But there is also relative to that, I asked Patrick if he was familiar with a lot of the federal programs. We get a lot of dollars that are relative to reducing emissions and that sort of thing. Patrick, if you could like explain any of that.
Sure.
Okay.
Chairman George, there's something called the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program, and there's a fair amount of revenue through the federal government that's available for programs that support alternative modes and other efforts to reduce congestion and obviously improve the quality of the air.
It's interesting. We met with one official about a month and a half ago, and I found that their interest in anything that will reduce pollution, reduce congestion, I thought was very heightened. They were looking for anything that would help reduce particularly the pollution in the inner city area, recognizing it's very expensive. If you start stacking highways, if you try to add lanes where you're taking out businesses in order to do it, they were looking for things that seemed to be similar to this kind of concept. So, okay. Any further questions? Great. Well, thank you.
I'm here to reiterate, Chairman George, members of the committee. My name is Eric Clover. I'm here to urge the support of Bill 173 and 451 in support of electric and gas scooters. My store sells exotic sports cars and motorcycles as well as alternative fuel vehicles such as the electric and gas assisted scooters. Consumer interest is huge for these scooters, and it's been increasing. We've sold them in the past to indoor manufacturing facilities, battery-powered scooters to get around, as well as large campus buildings, or like Nike in Beaverton. The existing laws are best difficult in those considering their use. They do not compare, of course, to scooters, the mopeds, and motorcycles that we do sell. And they're unsafe to use in the same lanes as automobiles and vehicles that have the power to go, exceed 25 miles an hour. The laws are more restrictive and stringent than necessary, and registering insurance should not be necessary on vehicles such as these. These small light-powered scooters fight traffic congestion and air pollution and are purchased by men and women of all age groups. They're used for very short trips, usually 5 miles or less, and do not require warm-up time necessary for a catalytic converter on, say, a normal car to become effective, and do not have the high rate of poisonous emissions. Since there are no rules governing the category or rider operation, I urge the committee to consider this important legislation of electric assisted under the category of electric assisted bicycles so they can operate in safe areas legally. That's all. Any questions?
The one question under Senate Bill 451 would be that we do have one of the units, the Urban Express, which seems to be on the base of watts, okay, but it is 2 miles an hour over. Is that something that needs to be adjusted in this? I mean, would that be excluded under the bill?
Chair George, in answer to your question, I noticed that too as I was putting the specifications together, and it's doubtful that scooter can go 22 miles an hour, and it could be a boast from the manufacturer. With me on there, it's not going to go much over 16 to 18 miles an hour. And with an adult on there, I doubt if it will exceed 20 miles an hour. However, we can have the manufacturer put a governor on those to reduce those speeds.
Mr. Chair, I think that there might be some 16-year-olds that would get it to go the max.
I got a bigger battery pack myself.
For the most part, these don't exceed 12 miles an hour. They're in the 10 to 12 mile an hour range.
I was trying to get it up to 12 down the hallway, and I just couldn't get it there.
Fair?
Yes.
Just coming to mind on liability insurance, how do, would this be through homeowners, people that would ride these kind of...
Chair George, Senator Messerly, the answer to your question is yes. Under homeowners, they would be covered the same as a bicycle.
How many other states recognize these in the form we're talking about that? Any idea on that?
I do. Senator George, thank you very much for that question. I'm glad you asked it. The state of California has recently enacted laws regarding scooters so that they are legal. As we speak, they're not. I can look into that and report back to you. I know that there's current legislation going on in several states, as it is here. But being such a new industry, it's not to the front yet.
Vice Chair Messler?
Just a question on that, on California. In their operation in California, they also non-titled, non-licensed vehicles.
Correct.
Well, nice.
Senator George, Chair George, Senator Metzger, the answer to your question is yes. There's no titling, no insurance.
No, and no license.
And no license, I guess. Excuse me about the insurance, special
way,
insurance.
As we were talking about raising money in the future, I have no question in my mind that if we decide we need money, we'll figure out some way to tax those things.
Senator George, as the industry grows and we see an abundance of these, I'm sure that you're absolutely right on.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your consideration. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
We had a lot of fun with it. Patrick?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The next testifier is Mr. Stan Porter of the ODOT Transportation Safety Division.
Good afternoon, Chair George and members of the committee. My name is Stan Porter. I'm the Safety Standards Coordinator and Motorcycle Safety Program Coordinator for Department of Transportation's Transportation Safety Division. The U.S. Department of Transportation, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, does not recognize motor-assisted scooters as vehicles, and these scooters have no federal vehicle safety standards or regulations for safety equipment or for manufacturing. Scooters are currently regulated by the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission as toys. Bicycles, including electric-assisted bicycles, are required by Oregon law to have certain safety equipment and perform the standards for brakes, reflectors, and lights when required. And we were wondering if these scooters would be required to do the same. Electric-assisted bicycles are limited to a speed of no greater than 20 miles per hour under Oregon law. And Senate Bill 173 would allow these scooters to go up to 24 miles per hour. Control of motor-assisted scooters at motor-driven speeds is in question for our agency. Because of the physical nature of the scooter, and we don't see the ones we're worried about here, the upright standing on the small platform type scooters, because of the physical nature of this scooter, it's logical to question whether adequate and safe control can be maintained during braking or maneuvering at 24 miles per hour. And mixing these very small and hard-to-see scooters into the transportation system is a major safety and awareness and enforcement concern. These scooters will be difficult for the transportation system users to see in that highway safety mix. Injuries to non-motorized scooters are occurring nationally at an increasing and alarming rate, and ODOT is concerned with these injuries to motor-assisted scooters could follow this same trend. And more importantly, the injuries would probably be more serious and could result in fatalities. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission reported 26,000 scooter-related injuries requiring emergency room treatment during the year 2000, And the Oregon State Police and ODOT were so concerned about scooter safety, they released a joint news release on November 16th of last year, and that's attached to this testimony.
Those were primarily the pedal ones?
Those were the push self-propelled version, right, which is the stand-on, like a stand-up skateboard with a gotcha. With a steering mechanism.
And do we have the numbers for bicycles? Is that nationwide use the 26,000 number for the...
I think
I have the number back in my office. And
Senator George, we can get that for you. In summary, ODOT thinks the scooters need to be tested or studied prior to introduction to the transportation system, and without such a study, testing, and standards development, ODOT is concerned that passage of Senate Bill 173 and 451-2 will endanger the users of these scooters by allowing them to mix with motor vehicles on the roadways. The California law was mentioned, and in California law, they only allow 16-year-old or older riders to use these in traffic. They must wear a helmet. They're limited to 15-mile-per-hour speeds. They cannot be used on any roads with speeds higher than 25 miles per hour. They have turn restrictions, so if they're traveling on the right-hand side of a two-way street and they want to turn left, they have to go to the curb, get off, and cross like a pedestrian, not under power. And then they also have equipment standards where if they ride them at night, they have to have reflectors, lights, et cetera.
Do they treat them differently than a bicycle? Because it would seem to be the same issue. I've seen some people in Portland do crazy things on bikes.
And California law does treat them very similar to a bicycle, with the exceptions that I mentioned here.
Well, let me ask you a question. If we modified the 24 to 20, and then we brought in a set of standards that said, you know, that ODOT shall examine these for, you know, for those safety considerations prior to the time that these would be authorized, assumption being that, you know, those would be reasonable standards, does your heartburn level go down with that?
Senator George, members of the committee, yes, the heartburn level will go down, but we're still very concerned about, there are no age limits in this bill, so in the Oregon versions, mm-hmm. and so our office is directly across from the skateboard park in Salem, and these are being used in the skateboard park, and they're being used by 7, 8, 9-year-old children, and they would be allowed under the current these bills 173 and 451 to ride those on the street without any traffic knowledge, mm-hmm. and no safety equipment. So we're very concerned under those areas.
We believe that the bill does include 16.
Yeah, Senator George, there is a. Then, if you can give me just one moment
certainly.
Here to pull out.
Shall I let Senator Messerly ask a question while you're looking?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering how long it would take ODOT to do their studies. What type of time frame we're looking at here?
Chair George, Senator Messerly, I have no idea on that right now.
Has there been any work done to date?
No, sir.
Let me follow up with that. How long did it take with the motorized bicycles?
Senator Chair George, the motorized bicycles do have safety standards. So that wasn't a problem. They have the same kind of safety standards as a bicycle does. So we did not need to do any studies on those.
Who set those standards?
The Consumer Product Safety Commission sets the bicycle safety standards, the steering mechanisms, brakes, et cetera.
Yeah, Senator George, I was just going to point out that there is a provision in both bills that notes that a person may operate an electric assisted bicycle or a motor assisted scooter without a driver's license or driver permit if the person is 16 years of age or older, which means you either have to have a driver's license or driving permit or a driver permit. So you could be 15, is that correct for that?
You could be
15 for a driver permit? Okay. So you'd have to either have a driver permit at 15 or a driver's license. Well, that's what it says. You either have to have, a person may operate an electric-assisted bicycle or a motor-assisted scooter without a driver license or driver permit if the person is 16 years of age or older. So you either have to have a driver's license, a driver permit, or you have to be 16 years of age or older.
Okay. Now, there's another thing, as we're talking about, you know, possible amendments, and that would be the consideration that anyone under the age of 18 would be required to wear at least a bicycle equivalent helmet. What's your thought on that?
Chair George, we like the wording in the California bill much better, where anyone riding one of these would be required to wear a helmet.
Okay.
Senator George, our testimony for 451 is exactly the same as for that bill, so I probably won't hand you that. Just has a difference between motor and electric is all.
Okay. But you didn't have the problem with the 20 mile an hour there, because that was actually part of that bill. Okay.
Very good. Who's next? The next testifier is Mr. Glenn Chastain from the Oregon State Police.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, do we have a copy of the legislation that was enacted by California?
No, we do not have a copy
of
the legislation.
Of what? Excuse me. Oh, no, we go ahead and sit down. Okay. Yes, we have it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Chastain. I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police. And the Oregon State Police has some areas of concern with both bills, Senate Bill 173 and Senate Bill 451. We understand that these types of vehicles are being currently sold in Oregon, and they're being operated on our highways, which is currently in violation of the Oregon Vehicle Code. We're also aware that the popularity of these vehicles will likely increase in the future. Our statutes today do not define these types of vehicles, nor does it define their safe operation. We agree that there is a need for language to fill the current void in our state statute. Senate Bill 173, however, will allow more than just these motorized scooters to be able to be operated on our highways. As written, a two-wheeled mini bike, those types that are powered with lawnmower-type engines, would be legal because they meet the definition of the loosely defined motor-assisted scooters. Also, any modified or created vehicle that meets the definition in Section 2 of this bill would be legal to operate on our highways. And I believe this is kind of the piece that was being discussed before I came up here. We're unaware of the intent of placing the motor-assisted scooter in ORS 807-020, that's Section 4, subsection 14 of the bill, which states that a person would not need an operator's license of 16 years of age or older. And the interpretation we came up with, that a 15-year-old does not need to have an operator's license to operate a bicycle, and these vehicles are being defined as a bicycle, thus a 15-year-old or younger would be allowed to operate these vehicles. We would request that the committee give serious consideration to adding language similar to California's statutes, which govern the use of these on highways, specifically for highways that are designated with a speed no greater than 25 miles an hour. This would keep the scooters and the operators on the highways to have this close to the same similar speed as the other vehicles traveling on the highway. And I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time. Thank you.
Glenn, do you think the thought behind this, I believe, is to keep them on bicycle lanes and not on the highway? Or do you believe we can write it to where that would be clear?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if the way the current statutes are written would allow them only to be operated in bicycle lanes. Currently, these two bills would allow them to be operated on city streets, on highways.
Okay. Just like a bicycle?
Correct.
Yeah, because I have bicyclists who ride down the farm to market roads that sometimes doing 5 miles an hour. And so you think there should be a difference between those? I mean, should we be telling bicyclists that they can't ride there too? Or do you think that these are so unusual as compared to a bicycle?
Chair George, I don't believe that if they're defined in the statutes as anything other than a bicycle, there'd be any difference in where they can operate. And that's why I requested specifically that they be limited to highways that have a designated speed of 25 miles an hour or less, and that keeps them on a roadway or a highway where they're being operated in similar speeds with the vehicles, and there's not that disparate speed of a 55 mile an hour highway and a 20 mile an hour scooter.
But wouldn't logic carry us to the idea that we should modify current bicycle law to exclude them from being on highway exceeding 25?
Senator George, most of the major highways that have bicycle traffic either have large shoulders and or bike lanes. I'm thinking of local around here in Salem, some of the other larger highways have the bicycle lanes attached to the highway. And if there is an unsafe operation of a bicycle on those highways, then it would fall under that statute for unsafe operation of a bicycle on the roadway.
Okay.
It's current statutes.
Senator Carter.
I know that I have to come out of the dark ages on a lot of things, but I'm a mother hen, so I can't help that. You know, with 9 children, 25 grandkids, I always worry about their safety. But does it concern you that we're having so many competing vehicles on in our streets and our roads today in terms of the police job to try to save lives? Does that concern you at all? And do you see where this is just another addition to the work that the men and women have to do on our streets and on our highways daily?
Chair George, Senator Carter, yes, in one aspect that is correct, and I believe that Stan Porter, when he did his testimony about the safety and the safe operation of these being difficult to see and visibility problems, if you drive around downtown and you are in the downtown core area where it's a one-way street and you have the bicycle couriers that are there, there is a competition already between bicycles and vehicles. The safe operators are not the ones causing the problems. It's those that are doing the things that are outside of normal operation. And anytime you add another vehicle into our transportation system, yes, you're going to have some competing requirements there for those vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, may I just ask a series of questions?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chastain, would you feel better if this bill would say that we would have to have the reflectors and the lights and the other things on it so that if indeed somebody go outside the boundaries of the law, that there would be some kind of safety for them? Because at dusk, it would be kind of hard to see this kind of stuff.
Chair George, Senator Carter, yes, any safety feature that could be placed into the bill that would protect the operator of these type of vehicles would just be that much better for the safe operation of the vehicles. The age, I heard Senator Brown make the mention of 16 and older, and I believe specifically that language should be in the bill and not left in a separate statute what talks about exemption from licensing. It should be specifically in the bill. That's very clear to everybody that there's no misinterpretation. The safety equipment such as reflectors and lights, under the current bills here, they define them as bicycles, and you have to take a second step to then go look at bicycle requirements. If it was specifically in the bill governing what these scooters were required to have, every safety feature that was possible would be much better.
Just a couple other questions. Do you think, because a lot of young people don't have driver's permit just because they're 15 or 16, do you think maybe that language is limiting, and that everybody that rode this at that particular age level would have to wear helmets or have certain safety measures that they have to go through?
Chair George, Senator Carter, I believe that when Stan Porter gave his testimony about keeping the bill similar to California's requiring everybody that operates these vehicles that can travel 20, 24 miles an hour, would be better to have helmets on all operators. As to answer the first part of your question, here again, the more safety features you can put into the bill, the easier it will be for us as law enforcement to enforce those laws and protect the operators.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I know what I'm going to ask. Do you think that the bill should reflect, and I know we talk about the dusk to dawn kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Maybe if the bill at certain age levels, Mr. Chairman, would reflect that, because in terms of age, again,
mm-hmm.
because...
half an hour before sunset.
You know, that kind of thing. Because we would like to believe that everybody likes to obey the law, but you and I both know that everybody does not obey the law. So I'm just, and
you're not referring to me right now.
Of course not, okay. Mr. Chairman. Not at all. Just in case we have some other big kids riding in the hallway. No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Sergeant, you know, as I read this, and I don't know if you've looked at it, and help me with this, because I'm not really certifiably smart on some of this, and as I was reading the language, I kept getting more confused. So maybe you can help me with this. And I'm looking at Section 5 of, in this case, Senate Bill 173, although we have similar language in the other bill, where it says an electric-assisted bicycle or a motor-assisted scooter shall be considered a bicycle rather than a motor vehicle for purposes of the Oregon Vehicle Code, except for otherwise specifically provided in statute. Then we go to Section 6, where we discuss the proper use of a bicycle on sidewalks. Yet we're supposed to have motor scooters not allowed to be used on sidewalks, I understand. Yet bicycles are permitted as long as they're not used unsafely on sidewalks, and this is defined now as a bicycle. So I am confused as to, do we have conflicting statute here, or is it just the fact that it's Thursday and it's late in the afternoon and my cognitive powers aren't working well? And it's about to snow.
Chair George, Senator Metzger, it is Thursday, that is correct. And, you know, on here, I think that what the intent was here is to, in Section 5, was to define the motor-assisted scooter or the electric-assisted scooter for Senate Bill 451 for all aspects of the Motor Vehicle Code to place them as a bicycle. However, under this specific statute, under Section 6, 814.410, it's talking about the safe operation of a bicycle on the sidewalk. It specifically states that you cannot ride these type of vehicles, the motor-assisted or electric-assisted scooters, on a sidewalk, and both bills have that component in it.
All right, so that's not confusing at all to anyone else. All right, but me. Okay, I just want to make sure.
I just believe that a specific exemption was placed there for those types of vehicles.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions? Okay, Glenn, thank you very much. I'm going to ask both
you
and Stan to be available to help possibly one of our committee members to work on amendments to the bill.
Chair George, I'd be happy to.
Okay. I think there are some very compelling issues relative to this vehicle from the standpoint of making our transit connections, the clean air problems and the transit problems or commute problems that you'd see, like, for example, in Portland or Salem. So I think it's worth working to save this thing. Do we have anyone else signed up?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chairman. Alan Kuderbau from Columbia Willamette Clean Cities.
I'm going to have to excuse himself.
Oh, is that right?
Okay, we lost it. All right. Okay. That's it?
That's everyone that signed up, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Anyone else would like to speak to the two bills? Okay. If not, then the assumption is that we're going to go ahead and work to draft some amendments. I'm seeing heads nodding. And I think we have everything clear. What we may do is Senator Carter has agreed to work on this effort. Okay.
Yes.
And so we'll tie in your motherly instincts and make sure they're safe.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so we will work to draft amendments to this bill. I think this is definitely worth pursuing from the standpoint of the goals of reducing automobile traffic in certain cities. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 173 and 451, and with a tap of the gavel, we will be adjourned. Thank you.